everyone, this is Chao Wen recording in May 2023. After finishing the first season of the Conductor's Podcast, I have decided to give this podcast project a dedicated website with more user-friendly functions. So now we have a brand new website called theconductorspodcast.com. Straightforward, right? And now we also have its own Instagram handle. It's also the same, The Conductor's Podcast. All the show notes have been moved to the new site, and I invite you to come check out all the resources, and happy listening.
You know, when you're starting out, and especially if it's your first time getting contacted by a company, like, of course you want to make it work. And of course you're worried like, oh, it's my first time getting contacted by them. Like, so I'm obviously not, you know, the top of their list. I'm new to them. So they need someone right now. And if I can't do it right now, maybe they won't call me. And so, I mean, you try to make things work where you can, but sometimes if something really doesn't work for you, you know, you have to turn it down, and then it makes sense to try to keep in touch with that organization, like reach out to them again next season, or even tell them like, I can't do something next month. I'm so sorry. I would have loved to, but my fall is open. You know, you can suggest something like that. Don't hesitate to suggest something like that or keep in touch with people. It's not good to pull out of gigs because you find something you like better. Like, it's not good to be known as someone who just takes the better thing and is flaky. Occasionally, you'll have a situation where it makes just sense to do that.
Hey there, welcome to the Conductor's Podcast. I'm your host, Chao Wen Ting, a conductor with over 20 years of experience working with professional symphony orchestras, opera houses, new music groups, and vocalists. I'm also founder of Girls Who Conduct and have mentored hundreds of conductors from across the globe. I created the Conductor's Podcast to share all the behind-the-scenes secrets with you while I interview conductors, musicians, and business gurus from around the world. This is a space created for conductors, conducting students, musicians, and non-musicians who are curious and interested in learning more about the profession, craft, industry, and business. Shy away from the real talk? No way. Money, hardship, growth, and the roller coaster of a conducting career are all topics we discuss here. I will give you simple, actionable, step-by-step strategies to help you take action on your big dream, move through the fear that's holding you back, and have a real impact. Now, pull up a seat, make sure you're cozy, and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. You probably knew already that I'm the founder of Girls Who Conduct. That's an organization supporting women-identifying and non-binary conductors in various stages of their training and career. And one of the programs that we do currently is a joint fellowship program between Girls Who Conduct and Georgia Symphony Orchestra. We took 6 fellows for this entire year. They are invited to Atlanta for 3 weekends for residency, where they observe the GSO rehearsal and concert and do conducting workshop. And we do a lot of the training program on Zoom as well. And this was one of the Zoom events that we had provided for our fellows, which was, again, open to a lot of other people, like almost all our event. And my guests are the Michelle Tin, Girls Who Conduct, Michelle Raffano, and Michelle DeRosso. And we had a discussion about assistant conductor positions in opera and symphony orchestra fields. And I thought this is such a wonderful conversation that we had, and also some really great questions from our participant. So I had their permission to edit this out as the number 35 episode. Without further ado, I'm going to let you listen to the conversation. And again, please check out any programs that we offer through Girls Who Conduct. And anytime if you have any questions or just want to share, just have things that you want to talk to, we are here for you. Reach out to me. You can always DM me on social media or send me an email at theconductorspodcast@gmail.com. just one word, theconductorspodcast@gmail.com. And I've said it a few times on the show, but again, if you can leave a review on Apple Podcast or subscribe or tell a friend about this show, I'll be really, really appreciated. Thank you so much. And here we go.
Welcome, everyone. And thanks for my colleagues to join us at this early morning time. I know Mr. Zero is always an early person. I don't start functioning well until much, much later.
No, I've turned into a morning person lately. So I wake up at 6:30 or 7. So
yes. All right. So I will start by asking my colleagues to introduce themselves a little bit about their background and how they get to where they are. So which one of you do you want to start with?
I can start out. I'll talk briefly. And if you all are interested in knowing something specifically that I'm talking about or brushing over, I'm more than happy to go deeper in anything that I'm going to say. Basically, my background is very different because I started as a performer, as a dancer and a performer in musical theater. And that's what I thought I wanted to do. And that's what I had been doing since I was 3 years old. I was parallelly studying orchestral conducting at the university. And so until I really was in front of an ensemble, I didn't decide that that's what I wanted to do with my life. But that day, being in front of an ensemble changed my perspective completely. It also coincided that I was doing a six-month season with a musical theater company in Argentina. So I was doing like 8 shows a week and all that. And I was not loving it. I was feeling I didn't have any control on the artistic product. And I was very frustrated by that. So then that's how I decided to switch completely into orchestral conducting and finish my degree, my undergraduate in orchestral conducting, and then came to the U.S. to pursue my master's at the University of Kentucky and then Arizona State University for my TMA. And then the pandemic hit exactly when I graduated, so May 2020. That was exciting. I thought I would never get a job, but I was wrong. I got a job February 2020. One that would be as interim director of orchestras at Cornell University. And I also got an assistant conductor position with North Carolina Symphony, which I currently have as well. So next year I'll be leaving Cornell and heading to North Carolina for my second year of assistant conductor. And thankfully this year I got an agent. So that really changed things because I started getting other kind of gigs that alone I was not getting. And I've been covering for St. Louis Symphony, NSO. I'm covering for Minnesota and San Diego coming up. And I was also a conducting fellow like my other two colleagues at the Dallas Opera. And I'm a conducting fellow with Chicago Symphony. I think that was very long. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
So, hi, everyone. I am the second Michelle of Michelle Squared. We have a fun joke of we are like similar age, both spell Michelle the same way. We are, Michelle DiRusso is Argentinian Italian. I am American Italian. So, you know, Michelle squared.
And the R, don't forget the R because
and the R.
At the beginning we were going to do MR close. And we're both, oh God, yeah.
Love it. Hi everyone. I'm Michelle Refrano. I live in Brooklyn. I grew up playing piano and was a piano major in college and I became interested in conducting around high school age. I grew up listening to classical music and to a lot of Italian opera with my grandfather, who was from Sicily and had moved to the United States. And I always really loved it. And I grew up playing piano and I actually never really loved performing solo piano. So I never thought I would be a professional musician because no one in my family knew much about the career path of a professional musician. So in my mind, I was like, it was either a solo pianist or I wouldn't do music. And so when I was later in high school and I was deciding what to study in college, I thought, you know, I would really miss music if I stopped. And I really love opera and I love orchestral music, despite just playing the piano and not always being needed to play an orchestra. And so I, you know, got the idea, oh, well, I really love the interpreting music and that side of things. Maybe I would like conducting. And so I did my bachelor's degree in piano while starting to study conducting. And the more I studied it and the more I got projects together with my friends and took conducting master classes and everything, the more I really fell in love with it. And so then I did my master's degree in orchestral conducting at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore. And during that time and right after, I, you know, started to get some freelance gigs, you know, but a lot of those gigs were opera. Like I started to seek out opera opportunities as assistant conductor or conducting with small companies. And no matter what I did, I always found I enjoyed the process of opera the most. Like it's a different process than orchestral rehearsals. And I do love orchestral repertoire, but it's a longer process for opera because you have the stage element and, you know, you work with a director to interpret the story and you work for a long time, like several weeks to several months with a cast and a director and an orchestra to put a whole project together. And I just really love that process and I love the storytelling aspect of it. And so I have pivoted from doing a variety of things to mostly doing opera now. I do have an ensemble I founded in New York called Protestra that is an activist orchestral ensemble. And we have several concerts this season, but I mostly am a freelance opera conductor. And I've worked with Glimmerglass Festival, Spoleto Festival USA, Florida Grand Opera, Juilliard School. I'll be heading to San Francisco Opera soon to be a cover conductor there. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of every year is different because it's more freelance. So I kind of go from one project to the next, but it's a lot of fun and I love it. So also happy to answer all the questions if you have any.
So just to reiterate, if you have any questions, please send me my way through chat. You can just say, hey, I have a question I want to ask. Or if you want me to read the question for you, then just type it out. But I will get started with Rafano because I think a lot of people are curious about the selection process, like how you get the gigs. That's a very big topic, but as we see, I would ask Michelle DeRosso the same question because for the North Carolina gig, there was a job posting and you apply and you go through the selection process, but we don't see a lot of assistant conductor for operas. So yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how that is like?
So opera career is very much not straightforward. And I have only taken a couple of auditions in my life. Most of the jobs I've gotten were because it was like a recommendation from someone I had worked with. So I'll tell you, like early on, the first couple of years after grad school, I did a couple festivals. A big one that helped me to make a lot of contacts in the opera industry and to get a lot of experience and that led to a lot more opportunities was the Glimmerglass Festival. I was a young artist conductor there for 2 summers. And that festival is in upstate New York. And it's interesting because most opera houses, like I don't know if you know about young artist programs, but opera in the US will often, opera houses in the US, opera festivals will often have a program that you can audition for as a singer or as a collaborative pianist, a rehearsal pianist. And you can take those auditions and then it's kind of like a fellowship young artist situation with that opera house or opera festival for the year. And so that's the path that a lot of singers and collaborative pianists take when they want to get into opera. But most companies don't have a position just for assistant conductor. Sometimes they'll have a position for like a collaborative pianist, rehearsal pianist who also is the cover conductor, but most don't have a position for just conductor. Glimmerglass Festival does have a position for just a conductor. And I am a pianist, but I don't work as a pianist anymore. Like it's a great skill to have, but I don't play in rehearsals anymore. I just conduct now. So Glimmerglass Festival, a couple other gigs I had, I did, you know, I got those opportunities and I worked really hard at them. And I'm happy to talk about like opera assistant conducting and, you know, what could be really helpful as an opera assistant conductor and how it's different, you know, from symphonic conducting. But, you know, you're a member of the music staff. So you're, of course, assisting the conductor and covering them. But you're also a really important member of the music staff, like to help the singers and to get the production off the ground because there are so many elements of an opera. And I always just worked really hard with every opportunity I could to be as helpful as possible to the conductor. And I was also never afraid to talk to the administration of the company or talk to the conductor I assisted and be like, hey, I loved working with you. Like, do you have any opportunities for next season? Or I'm currently looking to fill my fall schedule. I don't have anything. Like, do you have any recommendations? I'm looking for work for the fall. I particularly love assisting Italian opera. Like just telling people, you know, and if you were helpful and a good colleague to work with, opera world is really small. And the majority of my jobs have been recommendations from mentors or from conductors I've assisted. I've also reached out myself to several companies, just, you know, oh, I am so-and-so, I'm based in New York, I'm an assistant conductor, I just came from working on this production. If you need an assistant conductor for any operas in your fall season, like I would be interested to work with you. Here's my resume. And a lot of times you don't get a response, but sometimes you do. And sometimes you get a response like 2 years later when they're last minute looking for a replacement. And that's happened several times to me. So I know that's not really straightforward. But on the one hand, it's also nice because you, of course, can't ever control what comes your way, but you can control how much you put yourself out there, and you can control, you know, how good you are to work with and how hard you work at a job. And that will, you know, indicate if people want to hire you back, of course. So, yeah, that's not very straightforward, but it's definitely different.
That's great. And DeRosso, can you start with, I know you have some other like cover connecting jobs since you get an agent, but kind of backing up to how you get the North Carolina position. And can you tell us a little bit about how you apply? What was the selection process like? And I think a lot of people will be interested in that. Thank you.
Yeah. So I started applying for jobs 1 year before I was meant to graduate, and I was a little concerned because I was not making the cut on any of the assistant conductor positions. I think it also coincided that that year there were many big ones, like Philadelphia was opening up, and I don't think I was ready for those positions now looking back. But in the moment, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm applying to everything and getting rejected. So I was like a bit, you know, concerned, like next year I'm graduating, what am I going to do, you know? So the following year, I just kept applying. I really worked on tweaking my materials to see what worked and what didn't for my summer applications. And so when I kind of understood what I was sending and what was good, I tried to get good videos. The North Carolina position opened up, I think like December 2019. And so I applied and I was like, well, I hope I get an audition, but you never know, you know, that kind of thing. And then they did call me and I was like, oh my gosh, it was like my first assistant conductor position to do anything. And so the best thing about these auditions is that they don't pay for your traveling expenses. So they don't pay for your flights. They don't pay for your hotel. And it's a big expense, at least for me being a student, I couldn't really afford it. So it was a stretch, but I was like, okay, I need to do this. And, you know, also I was in Arizona, so flying from Arizona to North Carolina, that was quite expensive as well. And so then they had a first round. Some orchestras usually just have like a one in-person thing and that's it. But North Carolina had, every orchestra has their own process and however they want to select people. So in this case, I had to go once. And then it was, we were already, it was a lower number than the usual they have because it was a longer audition. So I think we were already like five, not very many people. And we were all meant to conduct 30 minutes. We had a list of repertoire that were mostly kind of excerpts. And we were supposed to manage our own time. So you had 30 minutes and you had to go through one excerpt to the other. In between of that, you had to do two little speeches that were meant to be 1 minute long, one for fourth graders and one for adults introducing the pieces that were coming next. And they also let us know which pieces we needed to rehearse and which ones needed to be run. So like Beethoven 5 First Movement, you needed to rehearse. Then, you know, the Kaiser Walzer, you couldn't rehearse, which is a very tricky one. Then you had a Tchaikovsky, you know, violin concerto movement 1. You don't meet with your soloist. You just go, no rehearsal. Debussy Prelude, you know, an excerpt, no rehearsal, just go. So basically they were trying to see if you could run through things and, you know, eventually not jump in, do that job because it's part of our job, right? If somebody gets sick, you just jump in and you have to be able to conduct the orchestra. So I think that the time management was also crucial because there were like 12 or 15 excerpts and only 30 minutes. So if you didn't know how to move on fast, you could screw it up very easily. So after that, there was an interview. It was only 15 minutes each person with the CEO and a part of the committee of the musicians and the education team. And they asked you several questions about like your background, if you have experience doing educational concerts. I had very interesting questions from them, actually. One was like, where do you see classical music going or what are the trends you're seeing? Which I thought it was interesting. Another one was, what makes you special that we should hire you, basically? And I was like, oh okay. So those kinds of questions. And then I thought that was it. And no, I got a call from the CEO and they were like, okay, now we've like pared down to 2 and you need to come in March 1 week to do an educational concert and cover for the week for the music director. And I was like, fine. Looking back, same thing. I'm like, they only paid for my hotel traveling expenses, right? I worked for free for a whole week, let's be honest. But, you know, we do it. It's part of the experience. And I was like, at least I'm not losing money. So of course I'm going to do this, right? And I took a week off from school. And the funny thing is that I was very sick, but it was the week that the pandemic started. So I flew in on Monday, and Tuesday, 10 a.m. was the educational concert with no rehearsal. And you need to prepare your own script. So same thing, I needed to know what's the timing, what were the things that could work for a concert like that, and, you know, be as clear as possible in my conducting, because I had no rehearsal. And the orchestra, I was like, hi, I'm back, you know, you haven't seen me. And, you know, it was very, very weird, stressful. And I felt like, oh my gosh, it's going to be a whole disaster. Like, how would they risk something like this? But I don't know, I guess they believed in me. So anyway, I just did that and then covered for the week. And well, my audition got cut short because of the pandemic, but that was the process.
That was an awesome story. So I was curious, do you still remember how you answered the question about why should we hire you? What's special about you?
I think I played my Latin female card, to be honest with you all. I was like, yeah, well, sometimes you have to, you know. I was like, I know that, but this is what you need to do, right? You need to do research on where you're going. And I did research the demographic population to see if they had a Latino community, if there's people that spoke Spanish. And so I did say that I thought that I could connect with a different audience from different backgrounds that maybe they haven't reached before, and that I would be more than happy to do bilingual things in Spanish and English, and I, you know, or Spanish educational concerts. And I also said that I thought that I had a very particular background that is not usually seen in conducting. And I thought that that was enriching for the experience of me working with the orchestra. That also usually backfires me, just so that you know, that usually say like, well, if you haven't played in an orchestra, and then how do you know? And I'm like, oh my gosh, here we go. So I'm used to getting those questions as well. But yeah, that's it.
So for your audition, you did an educational concert, which is a very common task that is given to the assistant conductor or conducting fellow, and blend words, whatever the music director doesn't want to do. That's very often lent to the assistant conductor, no matter it's pops or education, or sometimes the music director is very keen to those kind of things. They do it themselves, and then you go back to assisting or whatever. You do whatever the company and your boss needs of you. So coming back, we don't really learn a lot about educational concerts in schools. At least I didn't. Like kind of going from repertoire, from what to say, and how, as you say, how do you put pieces together so quickly? So what was the important things that you noted or you learned through the process of preparation?
Yeah, I think that for me, the most challenging thing is like I was doing like my doctoral degree and all of this stuff, right? And so they asked me like for each piece to explain a music concept. So I had to explain harmony or rhythm, simple stuff. But I was like, rhythm is the way that you get into this academic mindset of giving this definition. And it's like, kids don't care, you know. And so I think that was the biggest finding for me, to understand how to talk to children about music. And so I think I did like 10 scripts where I had ideas, and I talked to my mentors, and I asked them what things worked, what things didn't. So I think that it really helped me to have their actual experience of being in front of children and asking them what are the things that work. And so those, I incorporated those in my script. But I think it's keeping it short, like your little speeches are no longer than 2 minutes in between each piece, right? I was lucky that I did an educational concert at school that I created myself. But now looking back, same thing, I thought it was really lame. And I read from the script the whole time. It was terrible, but I think it was a good first approach, you know. And then I think that the engagement part, like you always need to be engaging with your kids. Otherwise, they fall asleep and they don't care. So by now, I think I know how to get them really rowdy. And it's kind of funny. And then I have always kids that say, no, you know, you're expecting, you ask something. I always ask something and they I'm supposed to say yes. And I always have one kid in the audience that says, no. And so I usually point that out and I'm like, well, I'm really sorry, but we'll have to move on. And so addressing those things, knowing how to manage things that happen in the moment, or, you know, maybe if your audience is not engaging, change things in the moment. I've done it before. Or if I know that I'm running behind, maybe speed up or shorten some speeches, but I'm still at the point that I need to write my full speech and I need to learn it by heart, like as if I was acting. Of course, I change things and I paraphrase things, but because English is not my first language, I get very, very nervous about speaking in public. And I think that reading from a script is not as engaging. And I like walking on stage and doing that kind of stuff. So it really takes me a lot of time, but I really memorize it. And I think it works really well. So I would suggest doing that, although it takes a lot of time.
So coming back to Raffano, and I was just curious because now the opera world seems to be doing more similar outraging kids version of opera productions and that. Do you have any experience or like doing such things? Or if you wanted to talk about what your usual tasks are throughout the many, many weeks of working on the project as assistant conductor.
Sure. So opera companies are definitely starting to do more outreach things, where I actually haven't worked with a company, an opera company. I'm going to schools. I have education concert experience as an assistant conductor for an orchestra, because I worked for like a children's orchestra, a little orchestra society in New York City for the first year after my master's degree, and did kind of similar things to what Michelle DeRusso was just talking about. I have worked with singers as an assistant opera conductor on preparing them for some of the outreach things that an opera house will do. So for example, I was the assistant conductor for La Boheme at Florida Grand Opera. And then the cover cast were all young artist singers. And then they also learned like a shortened version of it in English. So it was kind of a pared down story they would bring to schools. But a lot of times, just like a small school production, singers will learn. It's like, you know, a half hour condensed version of scenes, just like in English instead of Italian, or you know, in the native language of the population of the school. Usually just like the pianist will go with them, you know, to the singers to do this outreach thing. But I have, as an opera assistant conductor, given pre-concert talks about the opera. This was when I was a young artist conductor at Limerglass Festival. There are these pre-concert talks in the tent. And the music staff of each opera production, there will be the conductor, the assistant conductor, and then the head coach, the head vocal coach who plays the majority of the rehearsals and who coaches the singers. It's kind of open-ended what we can talk about. And we have to talk for like at least a half hour to 40 minutes about anything we want in the opera. And so I would do a variety of things of, you know, I would play some excerpts at the piano to give people a heads up about what to listen to. So for example, one summer there, I was the assistant conductor for Janáček's opera, The Cunning Little Vixen. And that opera is very known for having very specific themes for each character and animal. And so I think it makes it more interesting, of course, for the audience to be able to listen to, like, you know, the different themes that resemble or that represent each character or each emotion. And so I would play them on the piano so that going into the opera, they could listen for that and say like, oh, the fox is coming. I can hear the fox theme, you know? Then I was the assistant conductor for La Traviata, my second summer there. And I talked a lot more about the historical aspect and context of that opera. And that's a very famous opera that a lot of opera audiences will already be familiar with the music. But people don't necessarily know, like, it's actually quite interesting. The composer was actually kind of ahead of his time. They didn't have the word feminist back then, but, you know, he was very supportive of his wife and very pro-supporting and respecting women. And it was kind of ahead of his time. And his female characters are very strong. I talked a lot about, like, how his life and his beliefs tied into his writing of the opera. And so that was always interesting for me to do. But so that was a fun... I've done those things as an opera assistant conductor, but I mean, if you want me to talk about just the general opera assistant conductor duties, it is a range of course, you know, you have to learn the opera to be able to cover at any time, like step in for the conductor, but also there's a much longer rehearsal process. So, you know, you'll have anywhere from a couple weeks to a month of staging rehearsals prior to, you know, being in the theater with both the orchestra and the singer. And those staging rehearsals are for the director to, you know, tell the singers where to move and how to act while they're singing the opera, and a pianist plays an orchestral reduction in the staging room. And so since there are so many rehearsals, a lot of times, you know, maybe the conductor will have a conflict for a couple of rehearsals or a week, or just like, we'll be tired because it's a really long day. And they'll say, hey, I'm kind of tired. Can you conduct this last staging rehearsal? And you just have to be ready to conduct any of the rehearsals. And it's most helpful for the cast if you can really pay close attention to what the conductor does and really try to conduct it the same way. And so sometimes that's frustrating because if you don't agree with the conductor, you're like, I really don't like their tempo there. But it's going to be the most helpful for everyone if they can get used to what the real conductor is going to do. You know, if I came in and did things different in rehearsal, then they would get used to my tempi and then they'd be kind of confused when they went back to the conductor. So no two conductors are the same, and no, you're never going to conduct exactly like another conductor, but just to try to be observant, you know, of their tempos or their beat patterns or the artistic choices they've made, or if they give a note to a singer that they want something interpreted a certain way, or they want a breath here, then I'll note it in my score. And if the singer forgets that when I'm covering the rehearsal, I'll remind them because I want to make sure they're getting the same information the whole rehearsal process. So it's, and you know, the head coach should also be thinking the same way, the coach or pianist on that opera production. So it's really like a team effort to be on the music staff of an opera production, and everything just runs a lot more smoothly. And it's really helpful for the singers when you can think like that. I also very frequently have to rehearse a cover cast. And so, you know, a lot of opera houses will, of course, hire a cast to cover the main roles in case someone gets sick, especially in these COVID times. But always, I mean, it's very easy to have a cold and not be able to sing. You know, I, as a conductor, can conduct when I have a cold, but a singer can't necessarily sing. So the cover cast has to be ready, again, to step in at any moment, like the cover conductor has to be. And so I would spend most of my time rehearsing with the cover cast, and again, sharing the information of, oh, in the staging rehearsal, the director is going to ask you for this and the conductor will ask you for this. And if they have to step in, I want to make it as easy for them to do so as possible and make sure they're super prepared. And so I frequently rehearse the cover cast, and then some opera houses have either a final cover sing through, and the covers are usually, you know, like young professionals, young artists, maybe they have a small role in the opera, but they're covering a bigger role. Sometimes there will be a final cover sing through or a cover run just for, you know, in a rehearsal room, just to show the music staff and the conductor that they're prepared. And, you know, I'll conduct that. So I do those types of things in terms of covering and rehearsing. But then also too, an opera production is so big and there's so much going on. There are so many moving parts. There's the crew backstage, there's the creative directing team, and of course there's the orchestra in the pit, that it's really helpful for the conductor to have another set of eyes and ears throughout the hall. So right now I am the assistant conductor for the spring opera at Juilliard. And we actually have opening night tonight. And so I've spent this past week in tech rehearsal in the theater. The theater there is very interesting. Like, the acoustics are actually quite challenging. Every theater is different. The acoustics are different. And what the conductor is hearing in the pit might not be how it sounds out in the back of the hall. In the case of the theater I'm working in right now, there is a lag of sound from the pit to both the stage and the back of the hall. So the singers really have to rely more on sight of watching the conductor than on listening, or they will be singing behind from the audience's perspective. And also the sound sounds very dead in the pit. And so the players want to play very loud because there's not a lot of reverb. And they're like, why is my instrument sound so quiet? But actually out in the hall, the sound kind of goes up and back. So it's very loud in the back of the hall. And so if the orchestra players play loud in the pit, they'll cover the singers in the back of the hall. As an audience member, you won't even hear the singers. And so you have to tell, I've been giving feedback all week to the conductor of, oh, in this spot, like, the brass really need to play quieter because they're covering the singer. Or the strings are playing a little behind your beat, but by the time it gets to the back of the hall, it sounds really behind the beat and it's not together. And so I've been kind of running around the theater all week, giving feedback to the conductor and going backstage, you know, to ask the singers, like, oh, can you see the conductor? Can you hear the conductor? And just being another set of eyes and ears. Oh, and also too, another thing you have to be ready to do is the very first day we were in the theater, the conductor, everyone was telling the conductor, oh, the sound is very different out in the back of the house. And he was like, really? It's that different? Are you sure? And then he was like, Michelle, for the last 15 minutes of rehearsal, I want you to conduct a bunch of stuff and I want to go in the back of the hall and listen. And so I had to be ready at the Sitzprobe, of course, to just jump right in and conduct a bunch of stuff from the pit where the sound is different. The players were confused, so the conductor could go listen and then give his feedback. And I was prepared and it all went fine. But you know, so you just kind of have to be ready to help with whatever's needed because there are so many moving parts. And it's interesting because I was talking to another group of young conductors recently and they were saying, oh, you know, the assistant conductor in an opera production, do you really have a say? Is it really like an important role, or do you just kind of like sit there until you're asked to do something? And I was like, no, it's actually such an important role. Like, it's so important to have that supportive role to the conductor and to the singers, to like give them feedback, let them know what's going on. Like, the conductor often doesn't hear everything if they're busy focusing on the substitute horn player that we have. They weren't paying as much attention to the singers, so they can't see on stage if they're not directly looking that we can't hear a singer at one point because they're accidentally singing upstage and balance is bad. But I, in the audience taking notes, can say, oh, the singer's facing upstage there. That's why we can't hear them. I'm going to give them that note to sing out, you know, at the rate. It's kind of like a lot of, you know, running around and being eyes and ears in a lot of directions, but there's a lot to do. So that's my role. It's just a lot of jobs.
That sounds all like the reality in opera houses. But before going further, I wanted to ask a technical question to the both of you. We hear the terms sometimes used interchangeably, cover conductor, assistant conductor, sometimes you're conducting fellow doing cover conducting. Do you see them sometimes if you get a gig that it's said differently? Does it really mean that you do different work or it's pretty much the same? We'll start with Raffano since you're here in the spotlight.
So first of all, my job hasn't really been different based on the title I've been given. It's been just different based on the opera house and how much music staff they have. So if it's a smaller house and there's less music staff, the assistant conductor kind of helps with everything from conducting the chorus rehearsals to being the cover to everything. Now, if it's a bigger opera house, there will be a different chorus master to deal with the chorus, and there will be several vocal coaches to give notes to the singers. And so my job is more so covering the conductor. But to that extent, like, you know, bigger house with more music staff, I have a couple contracts coming up with big houses, and one of them is to be a cover conductor and one of them is to be an assistant conductor. And my role is similar for both. So it's kind of interchangeable. There are several big houses that might have several music staff, and they may have a main cover conductor and another assistant conductor, or like someone who's a rehearsal pianist plus assistant conductor who will serve as another member of music staff. And if the conductor were sick, like the cover conductor would go on. But that's only if there's a lot of music staff. So I know that's not very clear, but it's kind of been interchangeable in my experience so far.
Yeah, in my experience, it's been that if the orchestra already has a position for an assistant conductor, then if you go there just for a week, then you're the cover, because you wouldn't be the assistant conductor because they have someone there on staff that is regularly their assistant conductor. So that's why you're a cover conductor. So for example, if somebody comes to cover me, North Carolina Symphony, I'm the assistant conductor, so they would be the cover. And same when I go to NSO, or NSO is particularly weird because they don't have an assistant conductor, but they're still calling everybody a cover conductor, you know. So that's my experience. When I'm a conducting fellow, it depends on the organization, but it means that they're usually not paying you much or at all. So I think that in that experience, like, it has a money component. This summer, I'm like the conducting fellow and assistant conductor of Napa Valley Festival. And that's the reason for that is because I am the assistant conductor, the only one, but I'm also conducting fellow because it's part of an award. So they're giving me extra money as part of this fellowship that they have. So it's not really because it's really good, actually. It's not because I'm like, you know, just learning or whatever. It's because they have this specific fellowship and it's part of their program like that. But for example, Chicago Symphony, I'm a conducting fellow. It means that I'm like learning. They're not paying me anything. Maybe they pay me my flight to go do things in Chicago. For Dallas Opera, same thing. They do pay you a little, so it's actually really good, but it means that you're like in this learning process, right? And that's why it's a fellowship, I think. I don't know, Chowen, if you agree with this, but...
Yeah, so my experience is sometimes if they already have an assistant conductor and then they want someone else to cover, they're usually for two reasons. One is their assistant conductor has to take a leave. Their assistant conductor might be having a gig or conducting somewhere. Or two, you're on their radar. They want to see you conducting or kind of see if you're good to work with. They are some big orchestras. They have like so many tiers. They are associates, first assistant, second assistant, but sometimes they are all busy. They were just bringing someone that was recommended to them, just kind of to meet you in a sense. But now talking about money, I had a question for the two of you. I was wondering if you had experience that you ever had to turn down an opportunity, like a gig maybe for covering or assistant. No matter for whatever reason, maybe the dates don't match or it's not a particular repertoire that you're good enough to jump in very last minute or some other things that the negotiation broke through. How do you handle it? And do you fear that they won't call you back if you say no once?
I can answer that. And like, yes to all of those things. Like, you know, when you're starting out and especially if it's your first time getting contacted by a company, like, of course you want to make it work. And of course you're worried like, oh, it's my first time getting contacted by them. Like, so I'm obviously not, you know, the top of their list. I'm new to them. So they need someone right now. And if I can't do it right now, maybe they won't call me. And so, I mean, you try to make things work where you can, but sometimes if something really doesn't work for you, you know, you have to turn it down, and then it makes sense to try to keep in touch with that organization, like reach out to them again next season, or even tell them like, I can't do something next month. I'm so sorry. I would have loved to, but my fall is open. You know, you can suggest something like that. Don't hesitate to suggest something like that or keep in touch with people. It's not good to pull out of gigs because you find something you like better. Like, it's not good to be known as someone who just takes the better thing and is flaky. Occasionally you'll have a situation where it makes just sense to do that. It's happened to me a couple times that I've done that where, you know, I had something and it was just another opportunity that it was like, I couldn't say no to, or it was really so much more money, or it was, you know what I mean? Something I had been trying to do for a while. And you just have to make that choice where you're like, okay, the company that I am going to withdraw from, like, it wasn't a week before, like, it was for sure a heads up, but it was still like, you know, but it was a choice to make where I was like, that company, like, they might be mad at me and like not call me again, but it's like worth it for this thing. And you have to, that's not good. Like, you don't want to do that if you don't have to or ever, but sometimes it does make the most sense to, and it also like does happen. So I think you just have to be honest and tactful. If you do have to withdraw from something for a reason, like, I have always offered a suggestion of like, you know, I would suggest like these people to call instead. If you're trying to take something that you have a slight overlapping conflict of like a couple days or a couple weeks, and you want to make both gigs work, don't be afraid to ask for what you need. Like, they might say no, but it doesn't hurt to ask. And sometimes they'll really try to make it work for you. Like, I have had companies make it work for me where I got a leave from something for the first few days so that I could go late and they could still have me work. And I wouldn't have known if I didn't ask. You always have to try to be tactful and honest and weigh the fact of like, yeah, it is a reality that sometimes if you get a big opportunity, you won't get it again. Like, that's a reality. But also the industry is very small. And so becoming known as someone who's like unreliable or who's going to drop anything at the drop of a hat for something better, like, that's not, that will also like get around if you do it a lot. So you always have to weigh your decision, and it can like really be a bummer to say no to something that you would have loved to do, but you have a conflict. But sometimes you just have a conflict and it is what it is. And it's a good position to be in high demand, that you have several opportunities. So remind yourself of that, you know.
So you have something that you want to add?
I totally agree with Michelle Raffano, and I'll give a very like real example that happened to me a few months ago. I had to turn down a cover Conductor Week with New York Phil. And my agent got it for me. It was very last minute because, of course, it was last minute. I'm the bottom of the list, like Michelle Raffano was saying. And they told me on a Friday, and it was for Monday, right? And I had already committed to covering for AC Ballet that week 4 months ago. And I'm a loyal person, and I think that's important to me. But also, I was going through a lot of like burnout. And I was like, I cannot for the life of me learn this rep in a weekend. I cannot, and I don't want to. I need to rest. And I was going to Arizona. My family's there. So I was going to get to see my family. I was going to get to be with people that I know that I, you know, I lived there for a couple of years, and I'm alone in Ithaca. And I was, you know, I was feeling really lonely as well. And also, maybe they also, I knew that the conductor there had had a thing with his eye. So I really needed to be there because they didn't know if he was able to conduct, right? So it was a very real situation that they needed me there. It was not just I'll be sitting around. And so I said no. And I don't know, they haven't called me back. I'll let you know if they do. My agent managed it, but I think I regretted it for like a month. But I think I did the right thing because after that week, I was feeling mentally better. And sometimes your mental health is worth rejecting a gig, you know? I needed to be with my family. I needed to be in my second home. And also I felt, you know, New York Phil, they don't know me. It's just one cover week. It could go somewhere, but it could also not go anywhere and they never call me ever again. But AC Ballet, I know that they have been calling me consistently. And now I found out that they might give me a few Nutcracker performances in December next year. And so it's like, okay, I think this will pay off. Also, my family's there, so I do want to keep our relationship with Arizona and not burn that bridge down. So it was a very hard choice, but you will face those choices. And I think that being loyal maybe it doesn't pay off immediately, but I think it pays off in the long run. And I would like to be known as the person that commits to something and does it and not just, you know, flakes out. So I don't know. That's one real example that happens to me.
That's awesome. And since you mentioned agent, I wanted to ask both of your experience working with an agent. And I know a lot of people are curious, like how you find an agent. And it's funny because this morning I just got an agent contacting me, but they wanted me to pay them to do the work for them. I was like, no, I don't think that's what I need. I don't think I will want that any given time, because if I need to pay an agent to find work for me, I'm probably not there or not ready. And that's not a good fit, but just how I feel. But we'll start with DeRosa, because I know since you've been working with this particular agent, your career had broadened up in a sense. But just tell us a little bit about, like, kind of go back to the beginning of like how they contacted you.
I was just lucky, to be honest with you, because Mayan Chen, she's the mentor of Chicago Sinfonieta, and this agency contacted her and said, we're starting this new program for young conductors. Who do you have? And of course, she gave the name of all of us, right? It's not like she picked me. And then out of all the names, they contacted me and one other person. And I went through a series of interviews. It was quite intense, actually. It was like 3 rounds. And yeah, it was very, very intense. But well, they eventually signed me and I felt very comfortable from the beginning. I love them. I love all of them. I usually work specifically with one person, but then depending if the gigs are like East Coast or West Coast or Midwest, they have different people assigned to it. So I talk to other people and they're all amazing. I think that whoever you sign with, you need to sign with that really, with someone that really believes in you and in your future and your potential. So one of the questions that I thought it was crucial for me to ask them was like, so where do you see my career going, or where would you like me to be in the future, right? Or where do you want to take me? And if they don't have a clear image of that, then move on, because they're the ones vouching for you. They're the ones that got me this gig, being like, I promise you she'll be amazing and blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, I know that, you know, something that is against me apparently right now is that I didn't go to a very well-known school. And so usually there's some like doubt about hiring me or whatever. But eventually they got it from me. And if maybe they hadn't insisted so much, they wouldn't have gotten me these gigs, right? So you want someone that will really go for you the extra mile. Otherwise, it doesn't work. If you have to pay, I wouldn't do it, to be honest. I would just not do it. I agree. I know that's the thing. I know too many agencies that charge a retainer. I'm not going to do that. Also, look at the roster. If they have too many conductors, know for sure that they're not going to focus on you unless you're like, that's the thing. Some agencies pick conductors that are already on the top of their career, right? And then they're not doing much for them. So if you're like just starting and they have 20 conductors on roster, know that they're not going to be actively fighting to get you a job, right? So in my case, we're only 3. And so they're very dedicated to us and to finding jobs. So that's my experience.
Michelle brings up a lot of really good points, and my experience working with an agent. So I actually don't have an agent right now. My first agent I worked with, I think I signed them when I was 27 or so. And so to Michelle's point of, you know, talking about like, will they prioritize you and put you out there and like, where do they see your career going? Like, that's all, you know, so important. So I had the experience of an agent who, you know, I liked as a person, and they were a smaller agency and worked with a lot of opera directors. And that's actually how I got in touch with them, because they worked with a lot of opera directors that had, you know, good careers that I respected. I had worked with a few of them, and one of my director colleagues recommended me to this agent because they were trying to expand their roster and add a few opera conductors. And at first I was wary because I was like, oh, well, they haven't really worked with a lot of conductors before, so they know the industry, but do they know what conductors need? But on the other hand, if I was going to be one of their few conductors, I was like, well, they'll prioritize me. And I asked like several mentors I have in the industry about this. And, you know, people said, well, you know, if you get a good feeling from the agent, like, you know, and it seems like they're in your corner, like try it out, see if you like working with them. Like, it's a relationship and you don't have to stay in a relationship if it's not working for you, but like, you know, why not? And so I started to work with this agent and they were very supportive of me, but I found over time, like, didn't know enough about what conductors needed in terms of, you know, in opera, and also too, like, weren't putting me out there enough necessarily, like supported me, but like weren't doing the work of putting me out there. And so for like 2 years, I was the one who got all my jobs. I think they made a couple connections for me, but it was like mostly me. Like all the work I was getting was because of me. And then I was paying them.
Were you having to? Were you? No.
Well, so the thing is, like most of my, because I told you, like most of the jobs I've gotten were from connections from me. So it was like a recommendation that someone just recommended me for something because of the work I did. But you still have to pay your agent because they, like, you're on their roster, you know?
Well, that's the thing. My agency, they don't, because they're very transparent and honest. And they think that at this point in my career, it's not fair for them to get 15% of anything that I get by myself. And so they don't.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
but they're
really
very
interesting.
It's very special.
I was going to say, I don't think a lot of agents do that.
No, that's
why I love
them.
We did have an agreement that if it was under a certain amount, they wouldn't get a cut because I am early in my career, but there were plenty of things that like they did not, like I got the gig from a recommendation of someone and I paid them, like, you know?
Yeah.
And so it turned into a situation where just like they weren't doing anything for me. So I'm not working with them anymore. So right now I don't have an agent. And on the one hand, like it would be nice to, like, I'm hoping to find an agent I can work with who, you know, I get along with, who will be my advocate, who I like have a lot of respect for musicians on their roster. But I'm also like not too stressed about it because right now I'm getting work, you know, and I don't have to pay anyone a cut of it. So, you know, I think you have to like really trust your gut, ask the questions, like you're for sure interviewing them. I would never pay a retainer. Like, you know what I mean? If your agent isn't going to be getting you extra work, then it's just going to be you losing money, like, to be honest. And like some people say, oh, well, people take you more seriously if you have an agent. Like, yeah, if you're on a roster that's like well respected, people will like have some respect for that. But they won't take you more seriously because you're on any roster, because a lot of people are on a roster and like pay money to be on that roster. So people will have respect for you because of the artist you are and the work that you do and like the end, you know? So right now I don't have an agent and I'm fine. And I will probably work with another one in the future, but I definitely have learned a lot about like how to be discerning and like even more pointed questions to ask, because I didn't know much when I signed with my first agent. So it's an interesting subject for sure.
And I totally agree with what my both colleagues have said. And I just want to say, sometimes the only time I wish I had an agent was when I had to negotiate or had to turn down the job, because I felt it's less personal if it's coming from a third party than coming from me, say, hey, I can't work with you, as opposed to someone kind of negotiating on my behalf. But of course, you pay for the service and all that. Then, so since now we talked about agent and finding works, and of course we learned that recommendation is such an important thing. So I wanted to ask this big question to both Michelles. What is one thing or several things that you felt was so important when you were assisting, as opposed to when you were the boss? You're the music director, you can do things more of your way, but what have you learned in your journey that you felt it's such an important thing to note for our audience member here?
For me, the big thing that I think sets an assistant conductor apart and that I try to do and that I think makes me a good assistant conductor is to be very proactive and know that your role is to be like a supportive role and a team player. It doesn't mean you don't have an important role, like you have a really important role, but there are some assistant conductors, and I have had assistant conductors who kind of like made it a little about them, you know, like trying to get attention or sucking up to the conductor or maybe giving a singer or player's notes that like you didn't tell them to give. And it's kind of like they're not necessarily thinking of like the group as a whole. Whereas a good assistant conductor will, first of all, be like proactive. Like if your assistant conductor can hear a problem or see a problem or like give you information that you don't know and that will make the whole job that will make the whole thing better, then like that's incredibly useful. Like that's so priceless. And so I try to be really proactive in not only telling the conductor, hey, there's a balance problem, hey, this is a problem, but like solving it. Like, hey, so balance is a little tricky here, and I think it's because the brass sound really hot, so like rather than tell the whole orchestra to be quiet, like maybe just the trumpets can be a little lower there. And guess what? It solves their problem, and the conductor's life is easier and their performance is better, and they're going to be more likely to call me again to assist them because they're like, you helped me do my job better. But being a team player, like thinking ahead about what's needed to fill gaps before people have to ask you, like being just so ready to help. And knowing that it, like, yeah, your job is to be a supportive role and just like be there to kind of make the whole thing run more smoothly, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with everything you said. I think that not being in the way is a very important one. Also doing whatever is needed just to make the performance be better, do it, even if it's not your job. I was going to say is that for orchestra stuff, because you're there just for a week, sometimes it's hard to connect with the conductors. And don't feel bad if sometimes you don't connect with some conductors. It's a chemistry thing as well. And sometimes some conductors won't like you, and that's fine as well. But yeah, I would say like, don't put pressure on this relationship of trying to get something out of it. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And you don't want to be like, you don't want to seem desperate either. So I think it's also being the situation in the moment and asking a few questions here and there and see how it goes and take it from there.
So looking at time, I'm going to open the floor to anyone here wanting to jump in with questions. I didn't get any question through the chat, but if anyone want to just unmute, I think we can take a question or two. So if anyone wants to unmute and speak, or if you want me to read a question for you, you can send me a chat. It's a very quiet morning.
Michelle, what are you assisting on San Francisco, whatever?
Oh, I am assisting, it's called The Dream of the Red Chamber, and it's by composer Bright Sheng, and it's a contemporary opera. And Chao,
oh, that's a Chinese
reaction.
It's a Chinese, yeah. Literature. Did you read it?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm very excited. It's it's a Chinese folktale, right?
Not really. It's not a folktale. It's one of the legendary literature. But it was written in an old Chinese form. It's a great piece.
Michelle?
Daryl Ang is his name. I believe he's Singaporean. I haven't worked with him before. But no, I'm really excited. They premiered the work a few years ago. So this is like the re-premiere of the work. So Bright Sheng edited it and made some revisions. And then they're re-premiering it. And I have the vocal score that I've been studying. And since edits have been made, I still don't have the full score. And I'm going there in 2 weeks. So apparently it's going to be finished this week. And I'm going to be frantically marking my full score the next 2 weeks so I can get ready. But I'm excited, though. It's a cool piece.
All right. We have a question from Maria. And she was asking about taking note. So can you tell us when you're assisting, what kind of notes do you take? We'll start with Raffano, since I know you have a lot more parts to cover in the opera production.
Sure. What kind of notes do you take? So that's a really good question. And it's kind of funny because like everyone comes up with their own system. I am like, I call myself the queen of post-its, and like people I work with tease me, and my book is like my score is filled with post-its. But so these are the types of notes. So some will be just like general notes for singers. Like early in the process, if a singer is just like has an error, misses a word, like you prompt them, you correct them, because they're obviously like maybe still getting off book, right? They're still learning it. Later in the process, once they know the role, maybe if it's just like a pronunciation thing, a diction thing in a foreign language, or if they keep missing a line, then you'll give a note. So I'll keep kind of tabs on notes for singers, and you of course try to gauge what is something they need correcting or what's something like they mess up once, but like they know, like you don't need to tell them something they know they messed up. So keep track of singer notes. And then I will take just general orchestra notes, like, oh, I think we should check the notes there in the part that horn note keeps being wrong. Or I think we should give the notes to players, like check intonation there or something. Or especially during a tech rehearsal or dress rehearsal where time is like really pressing with both orchestra and singers on stage. You know, the conductor will be doing a run through of the show for the dress rehearsal, and then maybe you have a half hour at the end for a couple notes. And so I will try to flag the spots that were like the most emergency to go back to, so that once they are done conducting the opera and they're like tired and need a water or something, I can be like, okay, maestro, these are like three spots I noted that I think ensemble could probably use a review. And I tell them that information. You're never telling the conductor what to do, but you're trying to share helpful information so they can do their job better. And so I'll kind of give them my list at the end of a dress rehearsal of like, these are, I think, the main spots, like prioritize before them, the prioritize for them, like just my own notes. And then they can choose, like, you know, to go back to those, like, you know, help jog their memory of like what's needed. And then I take general balance notes when you're in the theater of just like trumpets quieter here. Like I couldn't hear the oboe solo there. Like can't hear the cello basses there. The hall, the acoustics are weird. And so it's, yeah, it's like general notes for rehearsal for the conductor because time is pressed, notes for the singers, and then balance notes. And sometimes balance notes will also apply to the chorus, and I'll also share them to the chorus master to tell the chorus.
So, when you give the notes to the conductor, do you put like page number or what do you do?
That's a great question. And I always ask the conductor how they want their notes, because some conductors just want you to take notes in your own score from the back of the hall during a run and then run up and sit behind them in the front row of seats. And then like they'll be right in front of you in the pit. And then you can like tell them. But others are like, please write the list down for me on a piece of paper and give it to me. And others have requested like, please write the list down for me with the score page number, with the score rehearsal number, so they can very quickly, like efficiently read it to the orchestra. So honestly, ask your conductor what they want, because some really want involvement from their assistant conductor and others are like, no, I'll remember the spots I have to go back to. It's fine. And they're kind of like more chill and like don't need you as much. So honestly, just ask people what they need. Like everyone's different. Great question. Great question. Also, great point, Michelle.
Do you also want to add something about taking notes?
No, I usually use post-its because I'm a visual learner. So whenever I put the post-it, if I go back to it, I remember what happened. But sometimes if I write it in a separate page, I don't. So I've had the problem that they see my score and it's full of post-its and they get freaked out. And I'm like, no, and I have to explain, you know. So I'm trying to find a way that I don't freak them out, because I also pick the most important spots. I've had conductors tell me, you know, I just want general stuff, and that's fine. Yeah. I give them the general stuff. Then I had someone that said, like, I want to know everything. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it depends.
So yeah, it depends. But you need to develop a good system. I think I'm always changing it and finding what works best. I don't think I have a set one right now, but I do use post-its.
Dan asked a question about social media, and Rafano, I would let you answer in the chat if that's okay.
Oh, sure.
The next question that was sent to me is from Amit. And Amit was asking that they're from Australia and the music scene is rather small, and they were wondering if you had any international gigs or contract, and if so, how did you make the connection?
I don't have a ton of experience, to be honest. Like, I've done a couple opera festival things in Europe, but it was like through connections here and like largely run by or involving people from the US. So I don't have a ton of experience there, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, same here. But I know that the thing that makes it the easiest is if your paperwork is clear, right? So for example, I have double citizenship. So whenever I apply for stuff in Europe, I try to make that clear, because I know that they won't have to run a visa for me or anything like that. So if you have any kind of advantage like that, I would make sure that it's clear when you're applying. But I don't have much experience, to be honest. Yeah.
Here is a question for Rafano. Are you also a pianist, and do you find that opera companies look more for coaches who want to conduct, or not so much?
It truly depends on the company. I'm also a pianist. I did work as a rehearsal pianist for like a few productions here and there when I finished school. I don't enjoy being a rehearsal pianist, and I don't think I'm a great rehearsal pianist, to be honest. Like, I'm an okay pianist, like for coaching singers and for my own skill set. I'm honestly not great at like sight reading or following a conductor. And it could be really worth it, you know, it's really worth it to have those skills. And if you're good at those skills, or if you want to get better at those skills, I would say there are more opportunities in opera houses around the US for coaches. And then sometimes they make those coaches assistant conductors, especially like mid-level houses, like where they don't have as much music staff. Like, a lot of B or C houses don't have the budget for like an assistant conductor, but they always have like a coach, or they might have a young artist coach. And then a lot of times they'll have that person do both roles. So if that's a route that interests you, and also you learn the repertoire really well when you're the coach, because you play it. So if that's a route that interests you, I would really suggest going that route. And for me, it was like, I started going that route, but I kept just getting more jobs as a conductor. And I took a few auditions for piano, and I like never won the auditions I took as a pianist. And I kept getting the things I did as a conductor. So I was like, okay, clearly I'm like not a great enough pianist, that this is like where I shine. So I just didn't pursue that route as much, but it's like a great route to pursue if like that's your strength. That's what I would say.
Especially in Europe, right?
Oh, in Europe, actually you have to. That's a good point, Michelle. In Europe, you have to. Like you know, they'll have like the Kapellmeister at like a lot of German opera houses. Like, you wouldn't be hired as just an assistant or cover conductor if you don't play piano. Like, you'd be a member of music staff, you would coach, you would play rehearsals, you'd lead the chorus, you would do it all. And that's a great way to get in with houses in Europe. But in the US, it's really a mixed bag. Like, there are companies that I won't be working for probably anytime soon because all of their assistant conductors like are also coaches and pianists. And I probably won't get hired there until I'm like hired as just the main conductor who doesn't have to play. But there are a lot of companies that have different roles for those things in the US. So
yeah, and I just want to say it really depends on the company, and a lot of the company, it's more about convenient for them. So like I'm conducting a main stage opera and I asked about assistant conductor, then they say, oh, we don't have the money to hire an extra person, so your chorus master would be your assistant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the next question coming from Latin, if I'm saying your name correct, the question was, what was or is the hardest challenge that you overcame or are still working on when you first started conducting and how you overcome those challenges?
Hardest challenge. I have a couple answers for that. One is just like learning all the music and like learning how to budget your time. And it's a thing I still work on and I still find challenging, especially if you have a freelance career that you can't totally control. So it's like, sometimes I'll have like a couple operas I've already done, and so I need to review them, but I already know them, and I'll have a lot of space in between gigs, and I'll be like, I'm not getting enough work. I'm not that stressed about music to learn. And other times, like this year, the next few months, I have literally so much music to learn. Every opera I'm doing is new or new to me. And I'm kind of like, how am I going to learn all this music? And like, you have to learn how to learn things quickly and well. You have to learn how to prioritize. Like, you're not going to be memorizing every single line if you only have a couple weeks to like learn something. You're going to start with like the trickiest spots, the tempo changes, the stuff that like the conductors really needed to navigate. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you learn just what to prioritize and you then learn it as well as you can in that amount of time. And then also if you have back-to-back gigs, like studying music for the next gig while you're on this gig is like a thing that I continue to struggle with, because I'm always like very invested in what I'm doing right now, and like budgeting the time for the next thing while I want to be doing well on this thing is like always challenging for me. My sunlight in my apartment just shifted here. So that's something I find challenging. And then also sometimes anxiety of like being a freelance performer and like not knowing what your work will be next year. Like, it was more anxiety inducing when I was first out of school and I was like, will I have a career? And I only have a couple gigs this year, and will I get hired? And now I've kind of like the past few years when I've been stressed of like, oh, I have a gap in my schedule, it ends up filling up. I keep getting work, you know what I mean? And so next year I have a lot of work. I'm still looking to fill a couple months, but like, I have also learned to kind of trust the process of like, I keep getting work and people keep wanting to hire me. And like, that's a really good sign. And so just like trust the process of that, like you will continue getting work. But a freelance career can be a little, the unknown can be frightening, you know, and you kind of just have to trust your skill set and keep putting yourself out there.
I agree on time management. Yeah. Time management is the hardest. It has been the hardest since I graduated, and I have too much music to learn all the time as well. And I think that's been the biggest challenge. So if you're young, learn as much music as you can. Look at the seasons of the symphony orchestras and learn the main symphonies. Trust me, they'll come back and you'll have to know them. So learning repertoire, I think that's the biggest. Yeah.
So I think you both just answered a little bit about the next question from Maria. So she was asking about the process of preparing or studying a score when you had to do it very fast. What do you prioritize? Raffano said about tempo changes, transitions, tempi, anything else that you both want to add?
The first thing I think is, you know, I'm going to be the cover conductor for this production or, you know, this week. And if I need to jump in, can I conduct this thing? That's the main thing that I focus on. So I study it in a way that is practical, and that if the conductor turns around and it's like, take over, I can do it, right? So whatever it takes me to that goal, that's my main goal. And then from that, I start, you know, going deeper into details and finding more. I always try to know about the piece, though, like where it comes from, how it was composed, all of that stuff. Historical context, I think it's always really important. So don't think that that's a detail, that's the structure of it. So I would say that, and then, you know, learning the music and knowing how, what are the tempi, what are the tricky spots. And yeah, I would say mainly that.
Yeah, for me, like also, and I'm like, my way of marking my scores is always evolving, but I have like a system to mark my scores that really helps me if I have to conduct something last minute. Like, not everyone does this, but I find it helps me for operas that I give like the main characters a different color that I can like highlight or underline in colored pencil. And so I know exactly who's singing when and who to cue. Sometimes I'll literally write, like, if it's just about, you know, oh, I know this spot, I have to learn something very quickly. I don't have time to memorize every single line and everything. I know there's a lot of mixed meter in the spot. It's going to be tricky for singers. I will just write whatever I have to on my score. I will write big mixed meter changes. I will write the beat that singers come in on so I can cue them on beat three. Like sometimes it's just a matter of like being clear and keeping traffic going. That's not, you know, the most musically deep like way to approach something of like you come in on three, you come up, but it's also the practicality of it. Like people need to come in correctly. It's my job to help them do that. So things like that. Like come up with a system for yourself so you can just navigate it. Like look at what people need you for and be able to do those things.
The last question on my list is, what are your thoughts making connections and getting professional opportunities while working on a conducting degree? This is from Gabriella.
I think that the biggest way I did any connections while I was in school was to try to go to rehearsals. If you're in a big city, just try to get into rehearsals. And then all the workshops I did, I carefully picked which ones I did. And I feel like those also created connections for me. Yeah, I think that anything that you can do outside school to get you in touch with the professional world is going to be extremely valuable, right? So if it's a workshop with someone that is already working professionally, those are the things I would prioritize. And yes, maybe there are some teachers from academia that are really good at everybody studies with, but if it's not a big one, I try to avoid those and go with professional people because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go into the professional path, right? So I focused on contacting those kind of conductors.
Yeah, to Michelle's point, I would echo the same thing of like, know what it is you want to do. And that's allowed to change and you don't have to know the exact specifics, but there are so many niche areas. Like there is a more educational route and professional orchestra route and opera route. And you know, and the world is really small. So for me, like I'm a big believer in just putting what you want out there, like being honest and just like telling people your goals. For me, I got into grad school, like not knowing that I mainly wanted to do opera, but I knew I loved opera and I wanted to do more of it. So I got to Peabody in orchestral conducting program and I got there and I said, I want to do opera. I'm really interested in opera. Like, you know, I told my teachers and I put together a recital of some opera excerpts, like with my singer friends. And I told the administration and the teachers, you know, one of the teachers recommended me to work for a small company he heard in the area. And then the administration recommended me to assist at the bigger opera company in Baltimore. And then that was my first ever professional assisting job. And I told that conductor, like, I'm new to opera, but I grew up listening to it and I really love it. And like, you do a lot of opera. If you ever need an assisting conductor anywhere else, I'd love to work for you. And he hired me somewhere else. And that was my second ever professional opera assisting gig. And then I went back to work for that company again later in the future. I still keep in touch with people at that company. So like, just, you know, be honest and like put yourself out there of like what you want to do. And people will be like, oh, she wants to do opera. We should call her for that. You know? So that's what happened for me.
I want to thank the Michelle R Square team for coming in and joining me. And also for those who were here, thank you so much for making time. And I hope that what we have shared was useful or somehow encouraging to a lot of you. There is no one direct path to the podium. That's what we at Girls Who Conduct have been trying really hard to advertise and to promote the idea. Everyone has a unique path and just there are a lot of difficulties as we all know. And if you ever want someone to talk to, we are here. We would love to hear your stories. You can reach out to us, to me personally, or anyone on our staff is totally welcome to hear your story. And then thank you all very much again for joining us. And thank you. Have a good rest of the day or evening, depending on where you are.
Bye. So nice to meet you all. Thanks for having us, Chow.
Nice to see you.
So nice to see you.
Bye.
Here you go, my friend. I hope that our conversation inspired you if you're a conducting student or a young conductor still working up the ladder. And if you're an experienced conductor, that you found some common ground in our experiences, or that you share and agree with our visions in helping the current and the next generations of conductors of color, minority conductors, or women conductors. I can only speak for myself, but I certainly don't want to be the first and or the only woman in my field anymore. I know we still have a long way to go before women can perhaps one day become the majority of the dominating gender in this field, but I'm really glad that we are working toward at least some gender parity on the podium. And it's really comforting to know that there are a lot of colleagues, both men and women, white and people of color, working towards this mission. If you haven't already, I would really encourage you to check out the website of Girls Who Conduct and a lot of great organizations working towards more diversity, inclusion, and equity in the field, including the one that Julia is involved with, the Women Band Directors International. Again, I'll put everything in the show notes and you can find things at chaowenting.com/31. And I will see you next week at the same time, same place. If you're loving this show, please don't forget to subscribe and or leave a review on Apple Podcast. And that would be the best encouragement for me. Thank you and bye for now.